Hello everyone and welcome back to Alice's On The Case. Today we are joined by Anne Olivarius. Anne, thank you so much for being here. Anne has studied at both Yale and Oxford. She was a leading figure in the Alexander and Yale case, which identified sexual harassment as a form of sexual discrimination under Title IX in the US. She has advised major figures such as Margaret Thatcher and Bill Gates. She is the founder of her own firm, McAllister Olivarius, in London and in the US. And she has been awarded the Honorary King's Council and the Officer of the Order of the British Empire. And you're an amazing person, and I'm so grateful to have you today.
Thank you, Maddie. Good to be here. Thanks.
So I thought we'd start off by talking about your first big case, I guess, Alexander and Yale. Can you tell our listeners a bit about this case, what sparked it, what you learned, what the outcome was?
Yeah, sure. You have to go back in time a bit, though, Maddie, because I'm 70 now, although I feel as young as 30, but nonetheless, I am 70 in terms of literal age. When I was at Yale, they had just taken women, really, at Yale. In 1969, they started taking women on sort of here and there, filling in the classes, but I entered with the class of 77, and there had been a few years then that they had fully committed to taking Yale. This is a time when Kingman Brewster, who was the president of Yale, was still saying publicly and quoted that Yale existed to train 1,000 male leaders every year. That was the mentality. So we were brought in, and it became a thing then that, you know, once there were women at Yale, where Yale men used to go to Vassar and other single-sex women's colleges, Smith, other places, it became something that, oh, you weren't good enough as a guy to find a woman at Yale, so you had to go off to these other colleges. So things were changing, and we weren't that many of us, but we were there. It was a very open sexual atmosphere with still a notion that, you know, we now had freedom to do what we wanted with our bodies. You know, Roe v. Wade had passed, so there was abortion rights in the states. And, you know, we had, I think, the mistaken notion, I realize now in the era of Trump, that things would continue to get better. And I really believed that things would get better. Trump has shown me that, no, you can go back. And now things are getting very, very worse, and fascism is with us, and it's really quite frightening what's happening. But I still believed then that we would keep all working together, and life would get better, and progress would come, and technology would advance. But when I was at Yale, I ran something called the Women's Caucus, which is still, because there were still only a few women at Yale, a minority to be sure. And the governing body at Yale, the Yale Corporation, asked me to write a report on the status of women at the institution. So by 1977, they felt it was time to catch our breath and take a look around. And were women still, you know, new, or were they settled in? Let's take a view on this. This is still Yale, where everywhere you went, there were pictures of old white men up on the walls, everywhere. You know, there was still a very, very pro-male, we just assumed men would run the universe, and the women were there for other purposes. But we were getting an education, but still the institution was still very much focused on men. So I said, fine, I would write the report. And I went around and interviewed many women and got about 30 statements. Some of them were fun statements by the women. But what came up was repeatedly stories of women undergraduates who said that they had had sex with their professors. And there were an awful lot of stories like this. And when you would look at some of these professors, you think, really, objectively, who would want to have sex with these guys? And, you know, you realize this was the playing field. Often they were divorced or going to divorce or maybe just having open marriages. And then they would take a look at their students and say, well, this is my field of access and I can have these women. And so I'll just do whatever I'm going to do to get them. So with this report, I wrote it and delivered it to the Yale Corporation. And we said that, look, there's an awful lot of pressure for sex by Yale professors, and then there were women who actually said, well, actually, I wouldn't say pressure for sex, I'd say I was raped. So we started talking about rape and how many women were having non-consensual sex. They were felt really forced into it. So I then went with these reports to this secretary of the university, Henry Chauncey, Sam Henry Chauncey, and I said to him, this is what our findings are. He was astounded, he couldn't believe it. He said, well, it's just a bunch of lies. Give me a list of the professors who, you know, have been accused. So I gave him a list of about 20 professors, male professors, who have all been having sex with students, and the students were saying it was rape. He said, well, I need the name of the women. You don't have to associate them with the male professors, but just the list of the women who are making these accusations. So I went back to the women and said, well, they want a list of the women who are, you know, testifying for us.
Yeah.
And so everybody agreed. So I gave him the list. And then he said, well, now we have to have the women who were assaulted by the men. So we had more meetings, and then we did provide that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was about graduation time, and I didn't come from a wealthy family, and I was cleaning rooms, which is a job you could get at Yale when just the term had ended, you're waiting for graduation, mm-hmm. and so you get paid to do that. I was doing that, and I had a call from Sam Chauncey, the secretary of the university, and he said that Keith Bryan, who was running the band,
yeah.
And who had been accused of rape by Ronnie Alexander, was about to file, you know, charges against him, was going to sue me. And I said, for what basis could he possibly sue me? And Sam said some things, and I listened, and I said, but hold on a second. Wouldn't Yale support me? You know, I'm mm-hmm. the one who's doing what you want. I'm faithfully reporting these things. Isn't this a problem that you want to solve?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you have sisters or mothers and daughters? And aren't you concerned about this?
Mm-hmm.
To which he said, we're going to support Keith Bryan and all these other professors that we listed. So I then wondered what to do, and I went down to the New Haven Law Collective, which was a group of Yale-trained lawyers who had just come out, and I said, I have a lawsuit I think we should bring, and I think it's on something called, let's call it sexual harassment, which was a term I was just beginning to hear in work context.
Mm-hmm.
This would be in education, and I think it's illegal under the, you know, laws of the United States. So we filed this lawsuit. And all we wanted was a database so that if you were sexually assaulted, you could go and report it. And so we would know if there was one predator or whether this predator was also raping many women.
Yeah.
We wanted some accountability on the universities so they could get a sense of the problem. How deep is this problem?
Yeah.
Yale wouldn't do that. I was called all sorts of stuff by important people. And one of the head of public information at the university when we filed the suit said to someone, Time Magazine reporter at the time, there was a man visiting from Time Magazine, and he said to the Time Magazine reporter that I was a lesbian, which he said it was not a compliment. He said it as a means of absolutely trying to destroy me.
Yeah.
And he didn't care what the truth was, but because I was fighting for women's rights, by definition, of course I had to be a dyke, as he put it. She has to be. And then also I was flunking out of Yale. Well, I graduated at the top of my class at Yale and, you know, got a Rhodes Scholarship, a Marshall Scholarship, got into Yale and Harvard Law Schools. These were not, you know, easy accomplishments any time in life, but certainly for women from my background. So it was all, and yes, I'm very supportive of gay rights, absolutely, but, you know, it was just dirt. And I thought, how could an institution do this?
Mm.
How could they deliberately lie? Why would and Yale, of all places, which I really believed in educational institutions and that they were excellent, and Yale was one of the finest, and I felt so honored to go to Yale. There's a banner at Yale that says, for God, for country, for Yale.
Yeah.
And we all sort of bought into that. This is an excellent institution based on meritocracy and really great values.
Yeah.
And here I was dealing with the Yale administration, and they were lying.
Yeah.
And they didn't care about the women. And I couldn't understand that. So the case went forward, and at the end, we were mooted out because it took so much time. We had graduated from Yale, so they said we didn't have standing to bring the suit because we weren't still at Yale.
Yeah.
There was a black woman who was able to stay in when it went to trial, and she was not believed. And so Raymond Duvall, the professor, white guy, went off into the sunset, and he's still out there. He's never been held accountable. But it was hard then for a black woman to sue a white male professor. That was really tough.
Yeah.
But what we did do, the judge found that sex discrimination, sexual harassment, they were one and the same, and that if you were sexually harassed at Yale, that Yale had an affirmative duty, i.e. all educational institutions had an affirmative duty, to realize that this was in violation of the laws of the United States, civil laws, civil rights laws, these are extreme violations, and they had to be attended to.
Yeah.
So we put sexual harassment law on the books there, and of course it's become now a staple for all institutions, academic around the world. People know the concept, here in Britain particularly, and then it's gone of course to corporations and other places where now the notion is deeply entrenched that you can't do it, it's illegal.
Wow, that's amazing. And how did it feel at the time? I I think it would be so interesting to hear how you felt both hearing all these stories from these women, and you say that your faith in Yale as an institution sort of diminished, but how did it feel as a woman hearing all these stories from other women telling you about their experiences? And then how did it feel to have the case both become successful and lead to this massive change, but also on an individual level to somewhat fall through? How did that feel and impact to you at the time?
Yeah, well, you know, I really believe in rule of law, which is why I became a lawyer. I almost became a doctor, but I decided rule of law is important. If we don't have a way to get redress for injustices, then the whole society falls apart. And you see this now in Trump's America, where people are really struggling to understand how he can do what he's doing, all these illegal acts. Every day I listen to the news thinking that's yet another impeachable offense. Every day it is shocking what's happened. So for me, what I also learned, though, I would say it radicalized me in a way. I mean, not in an overt burn your bra kind of way. No. But when I realized that almost every woman who I've spoken to, who I know, has been sexually assaulted or raped. It is a constant epidemic level violation of women throughout society. And I see it now, even so. And of course, the most vulnerable group are always that first and second year women who go to university. That's always a very, very vulnerable group. And it's really hard for them. But now I really believe that I think the most endemic crime in the world is assault and rape against women, and it happens all the time.
Yeah, I totally agree. And in terms of what you discuss about it being still a present issue, I listened to one of your podcasts, I think it was Kevin at the hearing, and you talked about this social view of women and how you think it has worsened or definitely changed since your time at Yale. And I think it'd be interesting to hear about that, because I know from my experience, a lot of people I talk to think, oh, sexual discrimination or harassment or rape, no, that's a thing of the past. You know, it's not a present day issue, you know. And I think especially they say if you're somewhere which is like a good institution like Yale, or if you're wealthier, or if you're of this, you know, skin tone or whatever, no, it doesn't happen to you. And so I think there's this whole culture that it doesn't affect people, but I think it does, and it spans across, you know, every person. So I think it'd be really interesting to hear, how do you think it's changed and how do you think it plays up today?
I think it's even worse today than when I was younger, perhaps because we have more understanding of it and we're talking about it out loud. We have a lot of rape cases that come here, sexual assault, and where it used to be years ago that the men would deny the rape. They'd say, no, never happened. Now, everyone says, oh yes, we had consensual sex. And then the men, almost to a T, all these cases, hundreds and hundreds of cases, will pause and then say, and she enjoyed it. Which I find so, you know, that woman being raped could enjoy the whole process. But I think what's also happened is the internet, which has brought the level of, you know, social understanding down in the universe, and porn. And the porn, you know, when you're age 11, most kids have seen porn. Most young men and women learn about how to have sex by watching porn. We know this across the world, with all these terrible things. And of course, the porn that you see, pornography doesn't elevate women. There's a few feminist, positive, uplifting, you know, sexual experience that may be captured in the light of porn. Okay, that's like 0.001%. The rest of it is mostly about the denigration of women. And you see all sorts of rough sex stuff. And I mean, I was just at Yale and gave a talk, and this woman came up afterwards and she said that she'd had sex before, but her boyfriend hadn't. So they agreed to have sex. In the midst of having sex for the first time for him at Yale, he starts to choke her. And she says, what are you doing? Stop it. Pushes him away. And he said, what's the matter? Don't you want this? I watch porn. Everybody wants this. The girls want this. Stop. You know, what is going on? Who would want to be choked having sex? It's really sad. And when I was at Yale, there was a whole positive discussion about our bodies, ourselves, and women getting educated about their sexuality. These days now, I mean, you don't hear women talking
about
it.
That's something
that, you know, educated women might be pursuing and doing with their partners, not all their partners, but with enlightened partners. But I don't hear that discussion. You don't read about that. You don't, you know, hear anything of it. And certainly in porn land, forget it. It's not being respected adored. It's a really different world, but somehow we haven't taken control of that. We don't own our own sexuality. We're not teaching other women and men about our sexuality, and that's really sad. So I think we've gone really backwards.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I would have these discussions with my peers, especially at school and in high school, and I would say to them, you know, what have you done? What have you tried with yourself, you know, as an individual? What have you experienced with your body? And all of them felt so much shame even to discuss it, which I think is the worst part, because it was so expected that the boys in the boys' boarding house would have all these things, and they would all have all these stories, and they would be trying everything, and it was wrong. And I mean, porn was a massive issue.
Yeah.
But I think they were so much more exposed, and that was just sort of a given.
Yeah.
Whereas for the girls, there was nothing.
Yeah.
Even discussing, you know, bringing up the clitoris, they didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really sad thing, to think that there's shame attached to something so normal and so, you know,
so positive.
Yeah.
And joyous.
Yeah.
We had a case about 10 years ago. I had a call from the Midwest, a place in the Midwest of the United States, and they said that there had been a sexual assault, and we were early on bringing laws to try and change things. Yeah. We were very much involved with lobbying and drafting legislation. So I went, and in this high school, so the girls are all 17, 18 at the top, you know, before they graduate. Yeah. Every single girl there were 93 in the class, girls, and they all had herpes around their mouths. And when I asked them, what is this? First of all, is it a rash? What's going on? Well, it became they all had venereal disease because they had been giving blowjobs to the guys. And I said to the girls, has one of those men ever done anything for you? Have they given you oral sex?
Yeah.
You know, have they given you anything, any pleasure? And everyone looked at me like, oh no, why would we do that? Yeah. So I would say to them, well, why are you doing this to the boys?
Mm.
Well, why would you do
that?
Okay. And so we're backwards. We're really going backwards, I think.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think it'd be interesting, what have you experienced in the legal sphere? So you see that in the social realm and in the thought processes and in the education. But how have you seen that play out legally and in the law and, you know, in the UK versus the US? Have you seen differences?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, we do a lot of drafting of potential legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, we had a thought here in recent years, just to be very current, that the United States has got something called the CDA, which means you cannot really do much about holding the platforms, the social media platforms, responsible for content.
Mm-hmm.
So we would get parents calling it saying their kid had committed suicide because the kid had been bullied, or their intimate pictures had been shown to all their school friends.
Mm-hmm.
What could be done? We were having a real struggle doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the thinking was that here in the UK, we can be advanced.
Mm-hmm.
We can change things because, of course, the internet covers the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can do legislation here that's positive, it will have an impact on what's happening in the States and undercut the CDA.
Okay.
So we decided to push for an online harms bill because the internet can be really dangerous for people. And how do you stop the trolling and the doxing and all the deep fakes and all the stuff going on? And how do you hold people accountable for what they do online?
Yeah.
And we're still early days. So one day I was drafting part of this legislation, which looked like really positive. We could get things done here that we couldn't get done in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a group of MPs around a table. I think there were, I can't remember, 7, 8, 9 male MPs and 3 women MPs. And these were all, the women MPs were all members of the British aristocracy. Well-educated, well-moneyed, beautiful women, mm-hmm. older age. And one of the men in the working session turned and said, well, you know, I don't know any women who have been raped. I don't think it's a big problem, you know, not a big deal. You know, none of you have been raped. He looked at the 3 women.
Oh.
Now, that's quite an extraordinary accusation, you know, putting them on the spot, should they respond. There was a quiet period, and then one woman said to me, said out loud to everyone, she was next to me, and she said, I've been raped 3 times, the first time gang raped. And he and the other men, members of parliament, looked like they'd been hit with a brick. And then, before they could respond, the woman next to her said, I've been raped too. And then the third one said, and I have been raped. And then I said, well, I have been raped also. So this makes it a full house, you know. And to which the men said, but we don't know anybody who's been raped. You know us, you know. And then I said to the 3 women, have you told your husbands or your partners? And none of them had done that, which is the other issue. And I said, well, I've fully disclosed to my husband. I'm also put my experience on the internet, so I'm not keeping it private, you know, because I think we need to, you know, like Mrs. Pellico in France, bravo to her. You know, you don't own the shame on this. It's not your fault. And, you know, those women said they just didn't. And I think that's the thing that happens. Women don't share those experiences. You tend to share them, if you will, maybe with your sisters, maybe with your friends. Yeah. But often it doesn't go further than that for all sorts of reasons. And I remember saying to one of the women afterwards, why haven't you told your husband? And she said, well, it just never came up in the conversation. I said, but how long have you been together? She said, like 32 years. You know, I thought, okay, you know, how interesting. But you could see people don't want to make themselves open on that. And when sex lives, and we do a lot of cases now where we have like men in Silicon Valley, and when they've got sexual infractions, they all just think whatever they do sexually now, it's fine. You don't have to tell the truth about it. It's all just between you and then this consensual partner, allegedly, whether they're consenting or not, is not real clear, but they just think it's their entitlement. So the whole notion of sex has changed. But online harms is what we're working on now to try and regulate the internet, because where it is now, it's a minefield for danger and abuse and hurting an awful lot of people.
And I feel like that's so interesting because, you know, when there was this rise of the internet and social media and things, yes, it was viewed very positively, but I think the negative was cyberbullying. And we know, I know we talked about that a lot in school and how cyberbullying can be a big thing. But then, yeah, the sexual realm and the influence that it's having. I know this is somewhat irrelevant, but the TV show Adolescent, I think, greatly shows that. And the influence that it can have on young children these days as well is, you know, incredibly terrible. And you just look at something like that and think, how do people not feel the urge to respond? And why is there not a bigger movement towards changing this? I think we see some of these things and we just choose to push them to the side. And we think, oh, well, that's not, you know, that's just a that's just fiction. That's not real. But actually, it is real, and it's so tangible. And when you speak to people and the experiences that they share, you see that it is such a prevalent issue.
Well, Adolescence, I thought, was a fantastic four-part series, all incredibly accurate.
No, that's very, very interesting.
I
wanted to shift a little bit now. I study feminist legal theory as one of my modules at university. And something that we've discussed is sort of the inherent discrimination in the law against women, whether that's the idea of the reasonable person, which is made by a man or was traditionally, you know, based around the male view, and how if someone is viewed, you know, if you're using the reasonable person standard, is that just a comparison to the reasonable man? And how do we, you know, overcome that?
And the idea of equality.
And is equality just comparing women to men? And is it this idea that we need to bring women up to the standard of a man? And what is that? And do we even want the so-called equality because men and women are different? You know, there are differences and we need to recognize this. And I think a lot of what we discuss in this module is, can we have tangible change? And can we actually, you know, create this so-called equality? Or can we create fairness and justice in the law without, you know, fully changing what we currently have? And not sure if, you know, abolition is necessarily the best approach, but what is your view? Do you see this play out? Do you see, you know, decisions where you're like, well, that's just wrong, you know? What do you see in your work?
Well, that's a big question. All right. So maybe a story might be most effective here. Some years ago, I decided that I would do some research on women Rhodes scholars. Now, it's after Cecil Rhodes, the, you know, one might say mass murderer and, you know, minder of diamonds, miner of diamonds in South Africa, Zimbabwe region. But you could say the Rhodes scholarship is probably the best single passport for success for a person to have, certainly in the United States and now increasingly around the world. I was a Rhodes Scholar in the early years. And so I started studying women because there was a book that the Rhodes Trust paid for by Philip Ziegler, A History of the Trust, and like somewhere in the 300 pages, he's written a couple of paragraphs on women, and then when they took women in 1977 to be Rhodes Scholars, that it hasn't improved the scholarship and the women are basically invisible and haven't done much. When I read that, maybe 10 years after that or something, I was so insulted. And I thought, what is he talking about? I'm going to go out there and get the data on women Rhodes scholars. So for over 10 years, almost 20 years, we've tracked women Rhodes scholars. What are they doing? It's probably the longest longitudinal study on elites in the world ever. Elites are hard things. You know, nobody wants to track elites, and that's got a lot of baggage to it. But the fact is, you've given this scholarship opportunity and trained all these women. So has it gone to good ends or what? Yeah. And one of the questions was to one of them, do you think you should get a Rhodes Scholarship if you're going to be a wife and mother and stay home? Should you have the Rhodes Scholarship? These were big issues. Yeah. And when I was at Yale for a law school weekend there, that was a big passionate issue of, you know, should you get a Yale law education if you're not going to use it? Yeah. You know, it's a real gift. What we're finding is that women increasingly are, you know, the exceptions to the rules. If you have a Rhodes Scholarship, you're an exception. Yeah. You're lucky, you've got a passport. And the women feel, though, that they owe it to change the world in a positive way. You see this as a consistent theme amongst the women, not amongst the men, yeah, but amongst the women. We also have a whole bunch of Rhodes men who have done illegal things. And it's fascinating to me that they don't lose their Rhodes Scholarships. Nobody wants to talk about that. They stay, yeah, which is something. There are three Rhodes women who have lost their Rhodes Scholarships just after they got them. For, I think, very flimsy reasons. One of them, Mackenzie Fierstein, who has gone public, yeah, she's now, you know, been found to be deserving of a Rhodes Scholarship by, it's a longer story, but University of Penn outed her and tried to get her to lose a Rhodes Scholarship. She did lose a Rhodes Scholarship by the woman warden who was there, Elizabeth Kiesch, yeah, who was a woman I really campaigned for positively to become warden of Rhodes, the first woman to have that job. Mm-hmm. But she's certainly anti-female, and she got rid of the Rhodes Scholarships for three women in a row, all three women. Yeah. I don't know any men who have ever lost their Rhodes Scholarships. The women were all abused in some way. They were traded out by other people who were jealous of them, who tried to report them, and they never investigated any other Rhodes Scholars, just those three who anonymous people, you know, went against. I mean, the whole thing is really dirty, and yeah, I don't think it's Rhodes Trust's finest moment. Well, right now we're contesting for Mackenzie Fierstein to give her her Rhodes Scholarship back, yeah, because she settled with the University of Pennsylvania, who clearly, in my opinion, you don't settle unless, you know, you did wrong. Yeah. So they've admitted that, so now she should get her Rhodes Scholarship back, is what were my argument. Yeah. But when we see this with the Women Rhodes Scholars, what we see is that women are becoming more and more advantaged in society, a lot of accolades. It's not just one woman doing this or that. We're all over the place. Yeah. We're the exceptions to the rule. But what you see is that the women are all balancing families, and they're the main runners of households, of their private lives. The men have a very different... Now, this is not every single man, every single woman. I'm talking major themes. Yeah. But you see this, that there is structural discrimination that is still so deep that even the Women Rhodes Scholars, who should be running the world with the passports that they have of the Rhodes Scholarship, mm-hmm, aren't doing that. Not, and some of them are ambitious enough to want to do that. Whether they should or not is another issue. But they want to. They're talented. They're deeply gifted. They want to really make the world a positive place in ways. And they're hitting structures. They're hitting problems because, you know, how do you do that and have a family and have a partner who you love, whether it's a male or female partner? How do you do all that? Mm-hmm. So we're studying that, and I think the world is certainly not equal, but we still know that equal pay for equal work doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not happening here in Britain. It's not happening in the States. Mm-hmm. The Trump issues, I mean, there's even somebody, I think, in the Midwestern state I heard the other day who's trying to take the vote, a Republican, the vote away from women. And to talk about going backwards, you know, there are such fundamental issues. You know, this whole thing also with Trump and the Epstein files that, yeah, you know, what is going on here? Right. You know, he won't turn them over. He's been deeply involved. You know, Andrew Lowney wrote this book entitled On Prince Andrew. Yeah. It's a fantastic book. He's a very careful historian. I commend it to you. Yeah. But in there, as he talks about, Epstein had, you know, was sleeping with Melania, and he introduced Melania to Donald Trump. Well, somehow, and, you know, of course, here's Melania, an illegal, you know, person who comes to the country. He's against immigrants, illegal immigrants, I thought, Donald Trump, you know. And here she's working essentially as an escort. You know, she's a prostitute. And nobody wants to really tell the truthful story. So where are we with women? You know, it's not in a good place. This is not a positive place. And I'm really concerned that we're going backwards rapidly, not just a little bit.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and it's terrifying, I think, because you know, you do hope that society progresses positively. And I think it's terrible to be in a society where people are thinking, oh, things are equal, whatever, or things are improving. But actually, you see tangibly that things are worsening, as
yes.
you say.
Well, for most women.
Yes.
For some of us, sure. You know, yeah. I can make millions and millions, sure.
Yeah.
But what do I give it back with my life? I dedicate myself to advancing women. So I put all the money I make pretty much into, you know, my family and and my family of women and people and good people who care about similar values of wanting to advantage everyone.
Yeah.
All right. And, you know, I run a firm. We're based on the principle that we can make money by doing good.
Yeah.
And we're really careful about that. We're not for sale. We don't represent people who call up and say, hey, you know, I'll pay your rates, regardless of what they are. Harvey Weinstein called me up years ago and he said, you know, I'll pay you $1 million if you'll take me on as a client. I said, no, thank you.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, you know, at the end, it was $3 million he was just going to give me for my pocket, so I didn't go against him. And I turned that down because I want to make my own money. I don't need his money. I'm certainly not going to support someone like Harvey Weinstein. You know, other people, you know, we really fight hard. We're really careful about the clients that we take.
Yeah.
We vet them first, you know, and I don't think everybody is entitled to a defense. I mean, sure, but not my defense.
Yeah.
I've been up against really wonderful lawyers sometimes, absolutely. And that's a joy when you have wonderful lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And you get good outcomes, generally, I've found in law, when you have really excellent lawyers on the other side, because then you get down to brass tack. What's the case? Do we have the facts? Do we have the law? Shall we settle this?
Yeah.
But, you know, when you don't have that, it's really hard to get justice. And what do? I mean, you've got to be careful. I don't want to sell our services. We've been up against the best. I've never met a law firm that's better than we are in terms of the talent of lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
We're as good as the very best. And I'm not for sale. So I'm not going to represent gun manufacturers. I'm not going to represent people against reproductive rights. No.
Yeah.
You know, that's really important to us. I'm not going to represent pornographers.
Mm-hmm.
They hurt people. I'm not going to represent cigarette companies. Why would I do that?
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to. And it means that I make less money, then I make less money.
Mm-hmm.
But then I feel good about myself and I've actually contributed something to, in a positive way, to what life is about and what's important.
Yeah. And I think that's so important, especially I know at LSE so many students are looking to go into the corporate field and or into commercial law. And I'm not saying that that's what all those firms do, but I do think profits and, you know, income is a big driving factor behind a lot of corporations, and it raises ethical questions of, you know, why are you doing that, and is it just for the money? And I think it's so encouraging to hear about a company which is fully invested in its clients and in the outcomes that you're seeking.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask as well, I know you mentioned that previously in a podcast that I've listened to that you consider the clients that you take on, and that if you don't think you can win a case to set a precedent, you would choose not to take it on.
Hmm.
How do you feel if you have a case come to you and you know there isn't the right legal climate or the legal environment for this right now, we won't win this, how do you feel turning those people down?
Oh boy. What you realize is that as a practicing lawyer long in the field, in the early days I used to take cases because my heart would go out to people. And that doesn't lead to good outcomes often. You might win your case, but there's no money to pay you. You can't keep your lights on. You can't run a business.
Mm.
So I've learned to become much more successfully careful.
Mm.
Not everybody we can help. We get calls all the time. People who have been in cults, spiritual misconduct, and been the victims of spiritual, you know, misconduct.
Mm.
It has been shocking to see how many people are harmed. And we can't help them because the laws don't exist. Maybe there's no online harms that we can go after people on.
Yeah.
We've created new law. We put revenge pornography on the books here in this country. We've done stuff like that.
Yeah.
We have to weigh those because you never know if you're going to make a dime on them. And if you can't make a penny and get any place, then sometimes you go out of business. You've got to be careful.
Yeah.
So we choose carefully. We try always to have cases that expand what people, the protections people have.
Yeah.
We only take cases we believe in. We vet them carefully first.
Yeah.
A lot of lawyers will take cases and if they're getting paid, they just take them and argue them. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the theory that, you know, we're for hire and okay. And you see what's happened in the States, like the Paul Weiss firm, a great law firm I've always admired, but they sold out to Trump. And a lot of firms have done that. Well, we're fighting, you know, those people, the law firms that are fighting Trump, we're one of them.
Yeah.
We're very strongly about that, felt about it. I think you have to realize that we get at least 20 approaches for representation every week. we're getting constant calls.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time. We try to vet them carefully. If we can help them, we take those cases. If we think they're not going to win, either because we believe their story, but maybe they don't have witnesses, maybe, you know, the law just isn't strong enough, or it's in a jurisdiction where we can't win, okay, then we're really, really careful about that. Some years ago, I had a woman of color call me in the States, and she said that she used to work for a big firm there, and they would lock her into the warehouse with other workers from midnight until 6, and they would load off boxes that would come in, and a massive firm that everybody knows about. And at 5 in the morning, she went into early labor, and she ended up delivering her baby. They couldn't get her out until they opened up at 6, and there were 13 men who worked there. Most were mentally defective in some capacity, because it was a positive employment process for most people to try and get people who had struggles with ordinary work to work and unloading boxes and doing stuff. They all stood around when she delivered this baby. Not that they didn't want to help, but they had not a clue what to do, you know, what to do. She delivered this baby. She called me. She said, "Would you represent me against this great institution?" And I said, "This case will win. You need to bring this case. But this is going to be in the South of the United States. And if I take this case, I can tell you, you know, it's going to be a struggle, because they're going to see me as an elite member of, you know, elite institutions. I'm a white girl, and they're going to look at me like, you know, we don't relate to her. You need to hire Bubba. Bubba from the South. Get some big fat white boy. And I'm going to send you $50,000 to give to Bubba to take this case so you can win this case." And she said, "Well, what if he wants more?" I said, no, I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to tell Bubba, $50,000 is what he gets. And for Bubba, that's probably going to be as good as he's ever going to get any place. You know, that's going to be it. And of course, Bubba took the case and won the case, because of course, locking people in, you know, even your worst juries are going to say, yeah, that shouldn't have happened. You know, people can relate to that. So we try to take cases where we change things for the positive. Other cases we take in the normal course of employment law, which we do an awful lot of employment law, both sides of the Atlantic, because there's a lot of problems. And we want people who, you know, people who work there get identified by their work. It makes them decide who they are as people often. It's their identities. So we want them to be protected, and we want employers to do the right by them. And most employers do want to do right. So we also represent employers doing that kind of work. And then when we see cases where we want to change things, we realize if we're not the person, it would have been an ego thing for me to take that case. I could have won it, but I might not have. And I didn't want to put at risk that woman and her experience. And we needed to change the law on that. We needed to make sure the corporate regulations about how this firm was operating would be changed. So we have to choose carefully what you can do. There's so many cases I'd like to take, but how can you possibly take? And like, we're doing cases in the spiritual misconduct area now, lots of cults, lots of religions. And they hire people often as lawyers who are members of the cults. They're not very good lawyers. They don't know what they're doing. And we have a couple of cases now, and we just are pulling our hair out to be up against lawyers who really don't know their stuff, who believe they've drunk the Kool-Aid of the religious practices or the cult practices that they're in. Then they don't have insurance. And then they all lie because they're protecting, of course. Oh, I'm protecting the church, you know, so I can lie for the better good. It's really tough, those cases. And we take some of them, and others we don't, because they are exhausting. And the victims are very damaged. And it's hard to represent those victims also sometimes because they're angry, they're hurt, they've been abused. And that's a real struggle. So,
it sounds like a very tough legal field in all regards, like discussing with clients, winning cases, putting down cases. It all seems emotionally challenging, but I suppose very rewarding on the flip side to have success.
I don't feel that ever. I always feel there's more I have to do. I feel so grateful, having come up in a pretty dysfunctional family, you know, in the States with not a lot of money. And then I've got, you know, I had a AFS, a foreign exchange student scholarship in 1972 that sent me to Peru for a summer. And the community paid for it, which was the greatest gift. It made all the difference in my life. Mr. Harneman, I remember Arthur Harneman, ran this group, the local group, and I will always be indebted to him and his family, because he sent me abroad for a summer. My parents wouldn't pay anything, you know, didn't really want me to go. And it opened my eyes to something in the world, what poverty really was. And although we were poor, we were never poor like what I saw in Peru. And then I got into Yale, and life changed for me, and I began to see opportunities and hope and visions. I wish that for other people, but you know, you, not everybody has it, but these scholarship programs are so important. They give people access to a life that might not have happened. I wouldn't be who I am if somebody hadn't invested in me as a person. So I think you've got to pay it forward. I spend my life trying to pay it forward to give to others some of the advantages that I've had so that they too can develop whatever is their best skills, their best sides of themselves. I want others to live in that way too. So I live mostly with the view that I'm not doing enough. I've got to do more. I'm 70, I feel like I'm 30, but okay, you know, I'd be blind not to realize that from 70 on, it becomes statistically, you know, people start to retire. You know, I went to a class reunion at Yale just last weekend in New York, and just a small group of my class, they'd all retired. Yeah. And I thought, wow, you know, I have no thought of retirement. You know, I hope to live to 100 and be active to my last moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows how that will go. So I mostly I feel not self-satisfaction, not at all. I feel I need to do more. I need to do a lot more. I need to do what I can to help make life better. And particularly since Trump is back in and, you know, his whole worldview of hate politics and lying and Fox News, how it's just a Goebbels propaganda network. It's very distressing.
Yeah.
And, you know, so mostly I'm energized to get out there and fight the next day to do the best I can every single day to try and make the world as good as I can make it for other people.
I think that's very inspiring, especially for all of our LEC students who are hopefully going out into the world hoping to make it a better place. But yeah, I see what you mean in terms of waking up each morning and not seeing the change as well. You might see it on a case-by-case level, but I think it is hard when you, especially in your lifetime, have seen it worsen in many ways, and I think that's difficult. But I do think you are definitely making change, and you, I mean, so many different things in the law have come about because of you and your firm, and the legacy that you leave here is incredible as well. I wanted to wrap up, in a way, with some advice that you would give for our students. Many LEC students are interested in corporate law, or perhaps now after listening to this podcast, interested in pursuing a career advocating for other people. But what advice would you give to our students going forward, either in the corporate sphere or following their passion? Just any advice in the legal world, what would you give?
Well, ideally, if you can, so a couple of things. If you can find a life partner to have that with, you know, somebody with you, that gives a lot of strength. I've had a long-term partnership with my husband. It could be male, female, whoever. But I think that's a real powerful thing to have that asset. And it's a great asset. Which is not to say that living alone is a bad life at all. No, not at all. I think there are lots of times in life. And, you know, indeed, I think if, you know, my husband were to predecease me, I would look forward to living alone. I mean, in a way, it's another way of living life, but I have friends then, and you want intimate friends, you want a network, and I have that kind of a network.
Yeah.
So I think that's important. You've got to get on your private life. For me, having children has been the greatest gift of my life. I've had a great love affair with my husband, and that's a gift, to be sure. My children are an enormous joy and pleasure, even at the times of great frustration or when they're angry at me, and some of them are all the time, but nothing is more important in that sense that I just completely identify with them. And I have a grandchild now for the first time, and I used to hear people my age talk about their grandchildren, and I would privately think, with arrogance, which I'm sad to admit, but I think, you know, these people talking about their grandchildren all the time, you know, Sammy, Johnny, this, and I think, get a life. You know, don't you have anything else to do than talk about your grandchildren? What are you doing? Now I have a grandchild, and I'm totally besotted with this daughter. I call her my young suffragette. Not that she has any politics yet, but I totally, totally adore her. My daughter sends videos of her a couple times a week, and I feast on these videos of her laughing, running, you know, talking about her stuffed animal, whatever it is. So that's a pleasure. But also, equally, you need work to define who you are. What is your contribution? What is your purpose? What are you living here for? What is your legacy? That's so important. And I'm so lucky because I get out of bed every day and I'm really aware that I've got so much to do. I love the work that I do. I want to make a positive difference. Every day I get up with stamina and vigor. I don't care if I'm tired. I don't care if I ache. I got to get out there and fight the next battle and do what I can. And you've got to find something that gives you pleasure. If it makes you a bit of money too, it's a nice thing because everybody needs to pay their bills. And I've been lucky to run a law firm and I've been able to make millions doing this. I plow it back into the business, but you can certainly make money and do good. And that, I think, is the ideal formula. Figure out a way to do that, and the world is as perfect as it can possibly be.
That's some amazing advice. Thank you so much, Anne, for coming onto the podcast. It has been a treat for me, honestly. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All the best.